Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
Terms and conditions apply. I love people and I love Judaism. And when I have an opportunity to bring those things together, yeah, that's amazing.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
And here I am with Shai Davidai.
So my guest today is a rabbi and educator, former director of HUK, and the co-founder with his wife Liat of KII, New York City. Here I am with Rabbi Moshe Meyerfeld.
Hello, Shai. Here I am. Very excited to be here. Delighted.
Just to, you know, we were talking on the way here with the production team, like how I know you. And it's this weird thing of how do I know people? Like, I think we ran into each other a couple of times. Yeah. I think we had the exact same interaction both times when you told me that you have 8 children, and I said you look too young to have 8 children. Yeah. And then I came and talked at Key, and I was just amazed by what you do, so I want to share that with the world.
Thank you.
But before we do that, I'm going to start with the question that I ask all our guests. Moshe Meyerfeld, what kind of a Jew are you?
Wow. How much time do we have for that? Shai,
that's the most Jewish answer you could ask.
Wow. I'm a Jew who doesn't believe in labels. And I don't want to critique your question, but the idea that I can be put in a box, I find difficult. And I guess that manifests to the way I relate to my community, to the Jewish world, and to the world at large. I'm a Jew who believes in everybody. I'm a Jew who believes that no one can be put in a box, and I don't like titles or you know, tags or labels for people. So I'm a Jew who believes in everybody, and I'm a Jew who believes in the enormity and beauty of the human, but also the enormity and beauty of the Jewish people as a whole, and the juxtaposition of my own individuality within the community is who I am. That's how I spend my days. That's how I live my life. That's how I view the world, and that's how I view people. You know, I don't see people as they say labels are for jars or labels are for clothing. You know, that's the meme. But I really believe that, and I really live that. And I think that comes out in who I am and how I interact with people. So if I had to, you know, put it briefly, who I am as a Jew. What kind of Jew? What was your wording?
What kind of a Jew?
What kind of a Jew I am? I'm a Jew who believes in every Jew.
A Jew who believes in every Jew. So, and we're going to get to that because I think that's a lot of the work that you do. And what does that mean, every Jew? But we'll unfold that. But to get to the work that you do now, we need, I believe, to start almost at the beginning.
Okay.
So you were born and raised in the U.S.
Yeah.
And when you were 17, you pack up and leave and make Aliyah to Israel. So what happens to, you know, little 17-year-old Moshe from New Jersey?
Yeah.
That says like, okay, I'm going to go.
It gets worse because we're in a relatively large city in New Jersey right now, currently where we're sitting. but I come from the farmlands, Hicktown. They used to say, I went from a small town that was so small, they used to say that we had to rent space from the town next to us to put up a sign, welcome to Norman, New Jersey. Like, that's like, you know, that's how small the town was. But it's actually a beautiful story because, and maybe it does actually, without me realizing it as a child, really ended up influencing who I am today as an adult, because I was born in a town that was really refugees. It was an enormous charitable act. There was a entrepreneur and a philanthropist who bought the land and gave it to refugees post-World War I, pre-World War II, where people had nothing, and they were coming from Russia, eventually from Germany and Poland. And there were a lot of German Jews, including my family. My dad was born in Frankfurt and was lucky enough to get out in 1938. He was born in 35. His parents, my grandparents, took this no-interest loan to start a chicken farm in New Jersey. Whoa. Okay. Now I live in Manhattan today. I want to tell the world that I'm a big city boy, but my roots are chicken farming in a hick town in New Jersey. That's where I come from. But my grandfather said that he became a chicken farmer. He was a businessman in Germany and he became a chicken farmer in New Jersey. And he said he did it for two reasons. He said, number one was that he knew that the chickens also spoke German. So he didn't have to worry about the language barrier. But he also said that he had heard about the challenges of the work week in America during wartime. And people had to work 7 days a week. And Shabbat was very important to him. And he said that the chickens will wait till Saturday night for him to collect the eggs. Mm. You know, he was his own boss. He was able to do his own thing. And the chickens didn't complain when he came to collect the eggs. So he became a chicken farmer. And he raised his family in a hick town, but also took responsibility for the town. Most people got their feet on the ground and left. I think in hindsight, the move was more traumatic for him than we like to believe within the family, right. But he never left. And the reason he never left was because he became the president of the synagogue and in charge of the school and in charge of, you know, the community and the mikveh and everything, and the people. And he would help people as they arrived and help them get on their feet and leave. And he ended up staying.
So he was the when we usually in Yiddish, you know, say,
I don't speak
it as yeah, like a negative yeah. thing, but yeah. he was like the positive version of a macher,
correct.
A maker, someone yeah. who just takes care of everything.
Exactly. Exactly. And that kind of became our DNA, in our spiritual DNA, certainly, caring for people and doing things for others, although I didn't realize it at the time. Then I had to grow up in a city with a bunch of chickens, okay? And I had no friends, you know, and I don't, you know, this is not a therapy session, and I'm not, you know, my parents, my mom.
You can make it a therapy session. You know?
You probably have
you
to charge me more, yeah. My mom is going to watch this with pride, so I don't, you know, and I love her dearly, and I want to make sure that she has only nachat from me. But, you know, growing up as a lonely teenager in a hick town wasn't so easy. I went to school in New York, and I had to find my own path. Like I didn't always behave the way my parents wanted me to. In fact, this is actually a sidebar, but fantastic. Our daughter, which, you know, we're going through all the different countries. Our daughter lives in England and wants to make sure that her kids can be American. So she's now applying for their applications to get their American citizenship. And she can't get it by herself because even though she has American citizenship, she was born in Israel. Yeah. And, you know, so she has to prove that I lived in America before she was married for X amount of years. So the easiest way to do that is actually high school transcripts. So I called my old high school this week and asked them for transcripts from my high school days. Now, this is a secretary, a receptionist who runs the office who never met me. She, you know, she's probably younger than me. She wasn't, you know, working there when I was in high school. She doesn't remember me. She came back and she said, your folder is really, really thick. I said, well, when they threaten that they're going to put things in your permanent record, they actually do. She's like, she's like, there are handwritten notes. I can't believe I'm saying this on the podcast, but there are handwritten notes that I wrote to teachers apologizing for things that I did in high school. Okay. So, you know, my trajectory was not necessarily to become a rabbi. That's for sure. Right. But I found my own path. Right. And I felt like when I was 17 and I finished high school in New York, I wanted to go to Israel. You know, my family was always Zionistic, and Israel was, I had an older brother who had lived there for a long time, another brother that had lived there shorter, but was already there. Much of my family had been to Israel to study at least for a year or two or three. So I went to Israel. I ended up falling in love with Israel, falling in love with Liat, and, you know, decided that we were staying there forever. Which didn't happen, mm-hmm. But at least that was the plan originally.
And in Israel, you became ordained as a rabbi?
I became a rabbi. I was quite young. I was 21 when I got rabbinical ordination. But I fell in love with Israel. I fell in love with Judaism. I fell in love with the people. And you know, becoming a rabbi wasn't necessarily an obvious calling, but it came with the territory because I cared for people.
Right. And you know, I don't, there's a lot of things about your past that are hard to find. I did call your high school. They wouldn't let me know.
You got a copies of the handwritten notes?
But one thing that did stick out is you became a rabbi, but then you started working with probably not the communities you'd expect a first young rabbi, you know, first time working with.
Right. So in Israel, I worked with troubled youth. I worked in a special program, a very unique, amazing program that dealt with kids mostly from outside of Israel, but came to Israel for a bit of space from their family, from their society, from the world that they were living in, but people who lived in Israel as well. And I would call it a yeshiva halfway house. It was drug rehab, alcohol. People had been from broken homes, been through abuse, with a lot of therapy and a lot of love and some Judaism thrown into the mix. Mm-hmm. And that was where I, you know, started my rabbinical career. And, you know, started learning there as well as teaching there. I did an intensive internship in drug counseling. I love people. So, you know, when I connect people to their heritage and to their future, and you believe in them and you can see, you know, I'll tell you an amazing story. There was a young man who joined our program in Israel, and he just to give you an idea, you know, I mean, he had in his shoe, he had cut open his shoe. He took it to a shoemaker and he brought $10,000 worth of LSD in his shoe to, you know, to start his career in Israel. Okay. I don't know if he planned on using any of it, but certainly selling it. And you know, he was into all kinds of drugs and doing all kinds of things. He was in our program, misbehaved in our program, and ended up getting asked to leave the dormitory, but was allowed to attend the day programs. He had nowhere to go, so he stayed in our house. My wife, Liat, and I invited him to stay with us with, you know, parameters and guidelines, but he stayed in our house. And eventually he did really well. He turned his life around. He became, you know, more mature and left the drug world and went through therapy and rehab, and he did really, really well. When we moved to England, which we'll get to, I guess, at some stage, but he called me on the first Rosh Hashanah there to say Shana Tova to me. And I said to him, you know, we'll call him David. I said, you know, David, you know, who would have thought? And he said to me, Moshe, you did. Mm. That blew me away. You know, like, I don't know if I really believed in him enough, but he felt like I did.
Right. And that's the important part. Yeah. Like, it's less about whether you believed in him, but whether you gave him the feeling that you believe in him. And sometimes that's what you need. You need someone to believe in you to keep going rather than you actually believing in them.
Yeah, and I think I did believe in him on some level. I didn't know if he would be.
I mean, you took the person into your home.
Correct.
That shows some belief.
That's Liat, not me, but yeah. I think he really, you know, he needed someone to be able to say, you can succeed, you can become something. And I guess colloquially, you know, just as a wording, I said, who would have thought? But he really inspired me. And I come back to that story in my own life all the time. It was almost 30 years ago now. But I, you know, I keep going back to that story. You thought of me. You believed in me. You trusted me. And I think that it's one of those vignettes that kind of I come back to, even though it was me, you know, that reminds me to just keep believing in people. And, you know, and people will innately, you know, God-given gifts and the soul that we have within us, it can thrive and can do great things. It gets covered sometimes, but allowed to express itself, it can fly.
That's nice. It's beautiful. How long did you stay in Israel? So you moved at 17.
I moved at 17. I was single. You know, I went to yeshiva. I actually was doing my university degree at the same time. You know, today it's you know, it's everyone's doing classes on Zoom, but for me it was an anomaly. I was doing, you know, we're talking about 1991, so doing classes, there was no online. I was doing classes virtually, and I did some classes actually in Israel, and I was convinced that I was going to make my first million by 21. So I had to finish college, you know. So at 17, 18, 19, I was learning in yeshiva. I was also doing college classes at the same time. I met Liat, great story, but, you know, I think we'll need another podcast for the dating version of the story. I actually was best friends with her sister, and everyone thought we should date, and Liat's 3 years older than me. You know, talk about looks, Liat looks younger than me, but she is 3 years older than me. And everyone thought that, I thought I was going to set her up with my brother because he's 4 years older than me, and then he got engaged, so I couldn't do that. I was like, okay, you know, and then we started dating. I got married very young. I was 19 when we got married.
Wow.
And ended up in Israel. You know, Liat had been to the army. She had, you know, served as a officer in an intelligence unit. We don't, you know, I don't know how much we can say here because it seems every time Liat disappears, something good in Israel happens. So we're not really sure exactly if her military service is over yet. But, you know, but officially she was there for 2.5 years. At that stage, we eventually got married, planned on living in Israel, had 3 children there, 3 beautiful children living in Israel, working this program for troubled youth. Liat was teaching in Jewish institutions, and we were loving Israel, and we were not planning on leaving. And then a job offer came from Aish in England and said, you know, come work with us. And we thought we'd go for 2 years and, you know, broaden our horizons, Europe, see the big wide world. And then 2 years became 20 years very quickly.
So explain that to me, right? Because like the obvious move for someone who came from the U.S. to Israel, if they leave Israel, is go back to the U.S.
Right.
Why choose the UK? And of course, you got the job offer from the UK, but you could have gotten job offers other places.
Fair question. I think I was a little bit cynical of America, and I didn't think that the Jewish people had a future in America. Maybe another topic.
20 years ago.
Yeah. Okay. 30 years ago.
30 years ago.
30 years ago. And I didn't feel like I wanted to be in America. Like I felt like I had left, and for good reason. And I just felt like I was past that. So what, you know, if someone had offered me a job in America, I think I would have outright said no. Mm-hmm. Because it was England, it was outside of my nose already. You know, maybe it goes into my personality a little bit, but there's a bit of a rebellious streak in me, you know, still. There's an element of me who always like has to do things a little bit differently. And maybe that's why I had to leave New York and kind of find my own path. But I was not interested in going back to America. It's a good question. I never really thought about it like this, but I think if someone had offered me the same job in America, I would have said no. Liat and I went for a pilot trip, just an investigatory, you know, and Liat always said, and it defines how we ended up there, really. She said it was a real wake-up call for her. You know, growing up in Israel, she did not grow up in a religious neighborhood, although her family was religious. She thought she knew the big wide world, right? And we got to England and we did a couple of classes and sample sort of sessions with different people. And we realized the unbelievable level of assimilation, of disconnect that the Jewish community had, the diaspora with Israel. And we were young and we were, you know, we had three children and we were able to do something about it.
But you used the word unbelievable. Typically people say unbelievably good or right. Unbelievably bad.
Yeah.
I'm sensing that you meant unbelievably bad.
It was shocking. It was not, we couldn't believe the level of disconnect, you know. Now, again, I'm fast forwarding to my American experience, but with our work with Key now, we're seeing it even more, mm-hmm. right? But once we're talking about unbelievable, you know, I think that I'm still shocked sometimes when I see people, how little, how disconnected, how unaware they are. We've invited people for Pesach, for Seder, and I'll say Passover, and I, you know, try to translate it, and they have no idea what I'm talking about. You know, and I'm like, you know, your grandparents with matzah, and there's a blank stare. Like, they don't even know what that means.
But so I want to ask you, I want to push about that, because, you know, obviously times change, but if you ask people 20 years ago in the US, in the UK, and about assimilation, they would have said, it wouldn't be a negative association, it would be a positive association. In fact, if you go back to, you know, the people that came with your grandfather and, you know, to a small town in New Jersey, they dreamt of assimilating.
Right.
Assimilation was good.
Right.
You know, finally we can be just normal people
right.
rather than the persecuted Jews that we are.
Right.
So just playing devil's advocate.
Yeah. That's a great question.
It seems like people were doing great. And then you show up and tell them, no, you need to know what your grandparents did.
Right. So I think there are stories that we've heard, and maybe it's even been fantasized about the people that threw off their tefillin, you know, on the boat, you know, arriving at Ellis Island. We won't need these in America, right? Leaving back the past. And people thought, I think, that was a solution to anti-Semitism. I think people saw that as a solution to poverty, you know, to their struggles. It turns out that it didn't really work that way. And we're certainly seeing that the assimilation that we have now, you know, in New York isn't helping us. You know, with the growing rate of anti-Semitic attacks, you know, it really is quite shocking the level of anti-Semitism we're facing in New York today in 2025, where we have positions of power and positions in the government and business. You know, I think that people thought that assimilation was a healthy, good thing. I would actually shift it a little bit. I think assimilation is dangerous because you don't know who you are. I think integration is healthy. I think, you know, I'm a proud American. I was proud to be in England. There was wonderful things about living in the diaspora. You know, we could talk about my Zionism and why I think that everyone should end up in Israel eventually, but that's a separate conversation as well. You know, the reality is there's wonderful things in the Galut. There are wonderful things in the diaspora. There are things that we can value and we can integrate and we can benefit from, so long as we don't forget who we are, where we come from, and where we're headed eventually. You know, and I think that that type of assimilation, you know, my niece is a I'll call it a mini celebrity in Israel. She was the head of the dance team of Netta when they won the Eurovision. If you saw a picture of her, you know who she is. Okay. Shout out to Shayna. She's wonderful. She and her wife came to America with a dance group, and they joined us for Friday night. And actually, because of the timing, it was able to. They had an event in the evening later, so we were able to have two Friday night dinners on the same Friday night. We had them early, her and her dance group. She had like 60 Israeli young ladies who were and two men, I think, in this dance group, and then we had a key dinner after that. But we managed. So there were key signs around or whatever, and they asked us what key was, which I'm assuming we'll get to at some stage. But you know, I told them what key was doing in New York, and you know, people were disconnected. And I said to someone that, I said to my niece, I said, there are people who we invite for Shabbat who say that, you know, when they hear what it is and what we're doing, they say they'd love to come. When is Shabbat? And I'll say it's at 7:30. And they said, no, what day of the week is Shabbat? Mm. And my niece looked at me and she said, Masto maret, Shabbat is Shabbat. Like, loosely translated, what's that supposed to mean? Saturday, you know, Shabbat Saturday. is Saturday, right? But it's not, it's Shabbat. In Israel, it's so much part of our identity that we don't even realize that it is a religious element to it, right? To so many people that we were discovering their lack of connection in England, going back to that part of the story, they didn't even know what Shabbat was. They had no connection to what Shabbat was. They had no idea what, you know, what it looked like or what it sounded like or what, you know, what was served at it, right?
So what made people who are so disconnected, and I really like the difference between assimilation and integration, but what made those assimilated people come and say, okay, Moshe, you look like a great person to learn from. Like, they could have just kept in their assimilated ways. It seems like something called them back to...
Good. So it's interesting that you ask that. And I think that there's a, you know, there was a time, and maybe it was in the 70s, you know, not before both of us, right? But in the 70s, when there was a movement, you know, from Chabad early days and Eshet Torah in Israel, where people were searching, right? The backpacker who would, you know, go on a journey and end up all over the world and eventually by accident end up in Jerusalem. And there, I think there was a little bit of almost of a, I wouldn't say negativity, but almost like a, oh, we're sorry for them. Like they're lost, right? Mm-hmm. And we're going to give them Judaism and they're going to be found, right?
Right. I mean, in Hebrew, they say Tinok Shavui, right? Tinok Shenishba.
Yeah.
Which I always found a bit condescending.
Right, exactly.
Like a baby that's been captured by the wrong parents.
And correct.
It's not their fault that they don't know.
Correct. And I always say, and Liat says this more strongly than I do, God doesn't make mistakes. You had the right parents, you were born in the right time, to the right people, in the right place. No judgments, right? And I think that's very important, yeah? That we believe in people, right? And we believe in the... So I think that shifted. You know, lost souls, I don't know if it was true or not, I wasn't there, right? But if it was true that these were lost souls who needed something to be found and somebody saved them, right, and gave them Judaism, I don't think that's true today. I think that people are searching for wisdom, and they're not lost, they're looking, and they're, you know, whether it's to go to college or to university or to a mental health professional or to a coach, people are looking for wisdom. They're looking to be happy. They're looking to be fulfilled. They're looking to be, and people are on a quest. You know, again, I know that we're on a timeline, but we're switching back and forth, especially in Manhattan today. We're talking about incredibly successful, driven people. You know, you can't be in Manhattan as a young professional if you're not making a lot of money. Yeah, I mean, you know, no one's giving you your little shoebox that costs $3,500 a month, right, for free. You got to make a lot of money to live in Manhattan. So these are upwardly mobile, successful people. And I think it was true in England as well. When people, they were very successful. But they also know good things when they see it.
But they're looking for more than just wisdom, it seems to me. It seems that they're also looking for something else that... or Jewish identity gives them, which is community.
That's the word we use all the time. Yeah. Community, I think, is the, you know, you stole my punchline, but I think
this is my podcast.
Says your name right there, right? But here I am, and it's bigger. Yeah. The reality is that people are looking for community for sure. And I think that when you know, I in my mind, I sort of, you know, what am I going to say when Shai asks me what is key, right? I was going to say that word, community, right? Now, what that goes with and how we define that community, we can discuss and unpack. But I think that's the reality. People are looking for community. People are looking for connection. People are looking to be heard. People are looking to be listened and to be seen and to be believed in. And when we offer them that in a non-threatening, non-judgmental way, you're not broken. I'm not fixing you. And I don't have a specific agenda or goal for you to look or be or do differently, which is maybe different in different outreach organizations and different, you know, communities, because some people do have a goal, but we don't, you know. And by the way, and I'm saying this very openly, it's bad for fundraising because business people like to see, you know, results, right? I'm investing X and I want to see Y. So when they come to me and say, what's your goal for, you know, for this community? We say to them, we don't have a goal. Our goal is community, right? How that manifests for every individual is going to be different, right? Going back to what kind of Jew am I, right? There's no defined way that a person's going to look, act, do. And I don't believe that there's a magic formula, certainly not that humans know, right? To say who's a better Jew and who's a worse Jew. There's no such thing. When people say I'm a bad Jew, it hurts me. Right, you know, there's a great apocryphal story. Yeah, I don't know if it's true or not, but about the Baal Shem Tov, the great Hasidic master who had a student who was a thief, right? And the thief used to steal and then come to him. Maybe he was at the Louvre this week, I don't know, right? The thief used to steal and come to him for a blessing and he didn't get caught. Again and again, he would steal, he'd go to the Baal Shem Tov for a blessing. The Baal Shem Tov would bless him and he didn't get caught. Again and again, every time the police were looking for him, he would steal. Baal Shem Tov gives him a blessing. Doesn't get caught. Sure enough, he goes to the Baal Shem Tov after a big heist, and they say, don't you know, the great Baal Shem Tov, the great Hasidic master has passed away. So what's he going to do? His rabbi gets, you know, is dead. Who is he going to get a blessing from? So they tell him, maybe go to this other person, maybe he'll give you a blessing. And the person he goes to throws him out. He says, what, I'm going to bless the thief, get out. Right, so he goes and he cries at the gravesite of the Baal Shem Tov. And the story goes that the Baal Shem Tov, you know, I'm a bit of a skeptic. That's why I said it's apocryphal. But the point is still there, right? The Baal Shem Tov comes in a dream and he says, you think I'm going to leave you alone, right? He says, you know, you can go to this student of mine and he's ready for you and he'll bless you and you'll be fine, right? But the storytellers always used to say, you know, no one wants to be the rabbi of thieves, yeah? Mm. I want to be the rabbi of the thieves, right? Mm. I want to be, and again, not in a judgmental way. But everybody has good in them. Everybody has something in their soul. So, and I struggle to see the externals. I struggle to see the misnomers of people. I believe in people, and when you believe in people, and I don't believe that there's a magical formula that everybody is going to be identical. And that's, you know, going back to what I said earlier about the juxtaposition of the personality and the community and the personality and the, you know, and the big picture, or the, you know, the individuality and the community, right? Going back to that, I think that people have to figure out their own path, and there isn't one specific path for every Jew. Hmm. What kind of Jew am I? I'm a Jew who believes that everybody has their own path.
So let's keep going on your path. So you spent 20 years in the UK.
Yeah. Interestingly, it was never planned. In other words, okay, we'll stay for 2 years. Okay, we'll extend our contract for 5 years. We'll extend our contract for another 2 years. We'll extend our contract. And as I grew, and I went to England when I was 23, as I grew, you know, in the role, and as I grew in the involvement that I was in, I became more senior in the organization. At first, I was just working on campus, and then I became the director of campus, and then I became managing director. And then, you know, as I grew in the organization, I took on more and more responsibility. I had a great team there, headed by Rabbi Naftali Schiff. Rabbi Daniel Rowe was there at the time. You know, he started when I was there as a young madrich, and eventually became the executive director. And it was a great team of people who really, you know, we were in the trenches together. We would stay up all night trying to make it, you know, figure out the next creative way to make a difference to the community, and dream and think and develop, and constantly, you know, striving to do more. And it was too exciting to leave. it was, you know, we were doing things. I was so thankful. I officiated at 70 weddings in England as a rabbi. You know, I became known as the selfie rabbi because, you know, I am who I am and I'm a bit rebellious and I'm under the chuppah. No one else gets that view, right? So I take a picture of the bride and groom and then take a selfie with them. And, you know, like, and everybody loved it. And it was like a signature of mine. And that, like, I was there for people when they were 17, 18, 19, early days. And then seeing them, you know, go from not knowing what Shabbat was to sending their kids to the Jewish school in London, you know, and the community was growing and we were part of something bigger and bigger, and Liat was doing great things, and the kids were, you know, England was great, and it was.
Have you seen the Jewish community change over those two decades?
There's an entire school in London today, which is alumni of Aish, that we were involved with, that didn't. There wasn't room for them in the Jewish schools. In other words, people who were sending to the standard mainstream schools, you know, were now looking for a place in a Jewish school, and there wasn't space for them, and they had to create a school. People are much more connected. People are, the intermarriage rate sort of stopped, you know, plummeting. It was growing every year. The intermarriage rate, the statistics were getting higher and higher. And after our efforts there, thank God, not just our, you know, ours collectively, things, you know, slowed down, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, from the Israelis, interestingly, because Liat's Israeli and Hebrew is her first language, she used to spend a lot of time working with Israelis, and it was an interesting shift there as well, because many of them thought of themselves as, you know, again, hate labels, thought of themselves as chiloni. Right? There's some secular
Jews.
So they'd come to London for business or for whatever, and they wouldn't even think of sending to the Jewish school because that's for the, you know, that's for the datim, that's for the religious people. So they would send their kids, and they realized how Jewish they were. And I want to put a pause on that to remember that conversation later when we talk about identity versus, you know, versus customs or politics, because they didn't see themselves as necessarily part of the Jewish London. But then when they went the mainstream London, they felt isolated and very lonely and very challenged. And I remember getting phone calls. Liat constantly would bring people that she was on a, you know, on a Facebook group, again, dating ourselves a little bit. But, you know, it was called Imas of London, right? And all these young moms who were, could we come see your sukkah, right? We want our kids to see a Chanukiah, to see, you know, what Hanukkah looks like. And they would come to our house, not as a museum, but like they missed the cultural Judaism that they thought wasn't part of their identity. And yet, when it was, you know, void, it really bothered them.
Right.
So
one of the things that the great things about Israel, but also the most difficult things about Israel, is that it is a state of the Jewish people.
Correct.
And people can argue what does that mean, and what are the laws, and what is Jewish, and who is Jewish, and all that stuff. But it is the state of the Jewish people, and when you the soil is Jewish.
Right.
Right. And I'm not talking about the actual soil, but like metaphorically, the soil is Jewish.
Yeah.
And you come there and you don't have to be Jewish because everything
Shabbat
around
is Shabbat,
you
right?
is Jewish. Yom Kippur,
exactly.
Everything stops. Even if you don't stop, you have to stop.
One of my mentors, my rabbis, Rabbi Beryl Wein, we could talk about him a bit. He used to say that in Israel, everybody knows when Shavuot is. They might know about it because Tanuva is running ads for their dairy products, and that's a right. You know, a custom that people have. But it's on the TV. You know it's coming, right? The buses say Chag Sameach on it. You can't avoid it, right? Whether you like it or not, yeah. And there are elements that, you know, we always say about, you know, separation of church and state in America. So Israel's complicated because there is no separation of church and state. It's because right. But you know, the statistics are. I think that's today, like 97-98% of homes in Israel have a mezuzah on them, right? I always say, thank God, it's
probably
not.
Probably 97 of the Jewish homes.
Right,
you gotta,
fair enough.
Be clear.
Fair enough. But I always say, thank God, it's not a law to put a mezuzah up. Because if it was a law to put a mezuzah up, I think that number would go drastically down,
right?
Because that's who we are, but don't tell me to do it, right? And that's okay. So to answer your question, which is, you know, a bit of a tangent, I think that when we came to England and the reason people got involved was because we were offering something of meaning, of connection, of purpose, of direction that was enhancing their integrated lives already.
And so we get back. So we went from the U.S. at 17 to Israel, to the U.K., 20 years in the U.K., and then back to the U.S., a few miles from where you grew up.
Yeah.
What was that transition? Why did you come back to the U.S.?
So interestingly, we don't like to use the word back, right? Because Liat really grew up in Israel, and although she was born in America, and I didn't live here as an adult. You know, I moved to Israel when I was 17, and certainly never lived in Manhattan. So that's like a whole, you know, we have, as you've mentioned, in shock, we have 8 children. Thank God we have 8 grandchildren. I don't know if the podcast can flash up some pictures now, you know.
Who knows? By the time it comes out, you're going to have 9 grandchildren. Who knows?
Well, okay. You know something I don't. Bishat Tova. In the right time, the right people. We have beautiful family, thank God. Of our 8 children, again, I don't know when this is going to be released, but 3 of them are married. One of them is engaged, right? 3 of them live in Israel. You know, we've got kids and, you know, 2 in England. It's like, but we often refer to our 4 younger children as 2.0, mm-hmm. right? Because there's a bit of a gap and the 4 older and then the 4 younger. We had an opportunity to leave England with a healthy, normal kind of break, right? It was always another year, another 2 years, another 3 years. We kind of hit our glass ceiling in England. We accomplished in a tremendous amount, but it was also, and I think this is very important to who we are as people, I never wanted to live somewhere just because, right? There always had to be purpose for it. And I felt like at that stage, we wanted to do more. We wanted to do something different. We wanted to keep growing as people. We wanted to be able to provide our skills and our talents and our, you know, and our purpose for living to a new cause, because it wasn't just the old cause, right? You can't just keep doing what you're doing. No one wants to be stagnant in this world. Well, some people do, but we certainly don't. That was never our education. That wasn't our mentality. So we believed so we looked around, where could we use our skills, our talents, where could we be put to use the best? And we were actually brought over by Fifth Avenue Synagogue as guest speakers in Manhattan. It's a big synagogue. Chief Rabbi of England used to be the rabbi there, so I kind of knew about it a little bit. And I was actually teaching it at a conference where the president heard me speak, and he said, "You should come." And then he heard Liat speak. He said, "Oh my gosh, you both should come. You're amazing as a couple and a team. We only need 1 hotel room, right?" And like, you know, so I said, "I have 8 kids, and they just brought us." Anyway, we spoke in Manhattan, and actually the same thing happened that happened when we went to England. When we went to England, and we were shocked about like the state of the union for the Jewish community. We got to Manhattan, and we were shocked about the state of the union of the Jewish community in Manhattan, especially for young professionals. We felt there was a real gap in the market.
What did you see?
We asked, like, just innocently, like, you know, what are the young professionals engaged with? What are they doing? What are the offerings? Who are the leadership levels? What's the grassroots, movements going on for Israel activism, for Jewish community life, for Friday night dinners? And we were, you know, and I don't mean this critical of what was, but we really felt there was something lacking for those who weren't naturally engaged otherwise. There were lots of offerings, synagogues like the one we spoke in, that had great programs if you were looking for one, right? But for the average Jew who may have been involved in a Hillel or a Chabad on campus, they came to Manhattan and there wasn't necessarily anything for them, nothing speaking to them, nothing engaging them. And we were a bit disappointed, and we said, okay, you know, let's start something. So we did.
You founded Key, which is interesting. You said you don't like being somewhere just because. Key means because.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does. So because what we sort of, we play with the word a little bit. You know, again, this is an amazing story and it means a lot to me. So I'd love to share it. We actually started with Aish originally, and then during COVID, that kind of fell apart. The finances fell apart, and we ended up having to relaunch independently. So we had been here for 1.5 years. COVID hit. You know, we were building something. We had 1,500 people through our doors. COVID, right? Okay, now the doors are closed. No one's, right? They wanted us to move to New Jersey, right? I'm like, I am not going back to
the chickens.
We had always said we didn't move our family halfway across the world to fall asleep in New Jersey, right? So we're in Manhattan, it's thriving, it's buzzing, it's busy. And, you know, we were naive. We thought COVID would last for 2 weeks, right? Why all these big changes? We're going to keep going. So we started Key. And the story of Key was we have 2 students. I call them students, they're friends. You know, they started as students when they were 17, 18, 19 in college and in England. But today they are, huge company in Israel, a branding company. They specialize in real estate, but they do a lot of different, you know, branding for big companies. And it was COVID and we were bored, and I called them and I said, I need your help. I need a name for an organization. And they said, you don't need a name, you need a brand, right? So they went through a process. Now their process is probably worth, I'm not exaggerating, you know, upwards of $40,000-$50,000. And they donated it to us because of our relationship with them over the years, right? And they, you know, they're very interesting. One is a gay married man living in Yafo. One is a religious man living in Renana with his wife and kids. You know, they're very different, and they're genuinely very, very close to us. Mm-hmm. And we spoke to them. We love them. And we spoke to them for days about, you know, the brand and who we are and what we are. And I said to them at some stage, this feels like therapy. And they said, good, then we know we're doing it right. And eventually we came up with our brand, and one of them said to us, you know, Moshe, it's amazing. You've been my rabbi for 20 years and I still call you Moshe. And the other one said, that's it. Judaism on a first name basis. So our tagline of before we even had the name, the tagline was Judaism on a first name basis, every individual on their personal path. Then we came up with the name. And Liat thought of Key because she loved, you know, maybe it was a bit COVID focused, but people were talking about key workers, you know, what was essential, what was, you know, key workers were allowed to be on the subway. No one else was, right? We were looking for a word that worked in Hebrew and in English. And we loved the idea of understanding a deeper, meaningful connection with Judaism. And that was Key because, right? It wasn't just because grandma did it or because I went to a school because someone's going to be angry or God's going to strike me down with lightning if I don't. Connect with the reasons, connect with the depth, connect with the because, just like every single person, you know, what's his name? Famous podcaster, come on.
Shai Davidai.
That's right, yeah. Who's the guy who's obsessed with the because? That everyone has to have their because?
Seth Godin.
Okay, yeah. So right? So everyone has to have their because.
Find your why, yeah.
Find your why. So we could cut that out.
No, you get to say Shai Davidai is a famous podcaster.
Shai Davidai is the most famous podcaster.
We got our take, let's go.
Okay, by the way, you should just know, I did a little bit of research and homework about the style of your podcast that I watched even before you invited me on, but I was really intimidated you had your wife on before me. That's like, once you had that, you already peaked. You're like, you had the best guest already, and like, what am I supposed to say? So anyway, the reality of Key was that we felt like people needed a because of Judaism. So, and we love the idea that it was dual usage. It was the English word of a key. It could unlock opportunities. It's that which is essential, but it's also the Hebrew word and the depth of what Judaism is all about, the because.
And
we spelt it K-I-I, right, because it's cool and it looks good. Interestingly, and my branding company, Capri, we love them. Josh and Richard, you're the best. If you look at the two eyes of Key, they're actually two humans leaning into each other. Right. It's community.
Right. I love that. And I love the, you know, Judaism on a first name basis, which, by the way, is Judaism. You got Abram, Sarah, Rachel, Jacob. You know, you have all, it's all first name basis.
Correct.
You know.
Yeah.
But one of the things that you also say a lot, you know, I've seen you write about it in interviews, about meeting Jews where they are. Mm. So I want to ask you, you know, you've spent years in Israel, years in the UK, now you're in the US. Where are the young Jews?
Wow.
And I'm sure it varies and some people are in different places, but the young Jews that are walking into your apartment, basically, which is Key headquarters, where are they?
Oof. That's a good question. You're good at this. See, this is why he's the best podcaster on, you know, available. It's an array. It is an array. You know, there are moments of incredible inspiration and excitement and confidence in our future. And then there are moments, I wouldn't want to say despair, but certainly of concern. You know, the Jew who doesn't know what a Shabbat looks like, that's concerning, right? The Jew who doesn't know who Abraham and Sarah is, if you don't know who your parents are, it's hard to be able to know who your children are going to be. And I think that there is a reality of that spectrum that we see, certainly in Manhattan. Look, there's a large percentage, very large percentage, of young Jews, postgraduate, who are spending time in New York. you know, it's an unofficial poll, and it's an I wouldn't say these numbers are statistically scientific, but from our sense, there's between 40 and 60% of graduates spend at least 2 to 10 years in Manhattan post-graduation. I think there needs to be, you know, people say sometimes, you know, are you competing with this organization or that organization? We need 20 more organizations. You know, just like Manhattan has tens of hospitals and tens of schools and, you know, and fire departments and, you know, police stations and all the essential, you know, restaurants and movie theaters and, you know, we need Jewish provisions for all those young professionals as well. It is transient, and that's why people don't like investing in it. It's also challenging because, as you mentioned, we live as a family in an apartment in Manhattan. Not everybody wants that, right? We found a magical space. It's not cheap, right? To be able to raise the money and to be able to run a nonprofit out of a place in Manhattan isn't easy. But we're in it, and we believe in it. To answer your question directly, I would say there's a spectrum. Our focus is the people who don't know who Abraham and Sarah are. Mm. Because I want to be the rabbi of the thieves. Yeah. Because I want to be able to, and I don't mean that disparagingly towards them. I want to be there for the people who haven't had a chance or weren't given the opportunity or didn't have the fortune to be able to know how rich our heritage is, to be part of our future, to be connected to the land of Israel, to connected to our amazing, amazing, powerful community. I feel like you see a good movie, you share it with your friends, right? You go to a good restaurant, the first thing you do is you put it on Instagram, tell the world why, not because you were there, because you want to share it with your inner circle, right? So I love being Jewish. And the two things that I love most in the world, besides my family, yeah, I love people, and I love Judaism. And when I have an opportunity to bring those things together, yeah, that's amazing. So I feel like there is offerings for the people who want to go to synagogue, who want to go to a Shabbat, you know, and there's plenty of opportunities for people to learn and to grow and to be involved easily. For the people who it's less accessible for, that's what Ki is here for. That's what Liat and I have given our time, our energy, our efforts, you know, our whole being, right, our lives, to those people, because those are the people who wouldn't have it without us.
But then you also have within Ki, now you have also Ki Latino.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, what is Ki Latino?
You say it very well.
I practice on the way, I have to say. Ilana is, you know, one of our executive producers, you know, she helped me. But what is that, Ki Latino? Why do you need a specific one for Latin America?
Great. So interesting. We found that there was a lot of young Jews that were from Spanish-speaking countries that were spending time here as well. Aside from that 40 to 60% of just the regular American post-grad, there are a lot of people who are here for educational opportunities, for business opportunities, that's spending some time here. And there were always, I would say, you know, not again to be negative, but somehow they would always make themselves more known at our Shabbat or our events or our programs in a good way. They would always be the ones to stay and offer to help to clean up afterwards. There's a real beautiful community, educational, I don't know, there's something about the soul of these Latin Jews who are just really warm and yummy. Yeah. So we found and again, we run a Ki event, and there was always 10, 20% of the attendees who we sort of discovered it by accident that they were the ones who always volunteered to help. And they were the ones who would stack the chairs afterwards, who would clear the table afterwards without being asked. And we were like, oh, you know, and so we started, and it actually happened by accident. We went to one of the young ladies had just moved into a new apartment. She asked me to come hang her mezuzah in her new apartment and speak to a couple friends for a few minutes what the mezuzah was about. Great, happy to do that. I went, hung the mezuzah, and we ended up having dinner together and schmoozing, and, you know, I said I don't speak Yiddish, but I used the word schmoozing. Yeah, we're talking and chatting, and they said, you know, we would love to do more of this. And I said, great, this is what Ki does. And I said, well, we need a space that we could speak Spanish and be comfortable in within our own community. Community within a community, the balance, the juxtaposition between the individuality and the big picture, right? So I say, well, it's ironic, I don't speak Spanish. They're like, but we love you and we love your home, we don't care, right? And that's how it was launched. And now we have this wonderful woman, Sabrina, who's working with us, who's spearheading it, and she's doing big projects.
She's from Panama.
And she's now launched this amazing project of the largest Havdalah candle, breaking a world record. You know, it's going to be this massive structure, lighting in Times Square. She's a powerhouse, and she's rallied everybody around her. And she informally was doing it anyway. And they're the key Latino community is a community within the community. The reason I love them, not only are they wonderful and uniquely and special in their own right, but they're also a great asset for the American counterparts because they are more traditional. They are more aware. They do have a stronger sense of community and Jewish values than their American counterparts. And in a way, they sometimes act as a natural madrich, you know, at a Shabbat table or at a, you know, at an event. They bridge the gap between the rabbi, you know, and the American participant a little bit better. Right. So there's a dual value of them being involved for their own right, but also as part of the community. And I think that that is an element that we haven't spoken about. But the leadership element of Judaism is very important to us as well. Taking responsibility. If you know something, share it with a friend. If you enjoyed an event, bring in someone to the next event with you. Like that leadership element was really taught to me by Rav Noach Weinberg, the founder of Aish, and really instilled in us in a powerful way. And again, that resonated with me from my parents. For my grandparents, you know, taking responsibility for the community.
Yeah, who is your ideal key participant? Like someone who walks through the doors.
Wow. I think I've touched on a few different, you know, of the range. There's a guy in my mind who's the ideal. I'm not going to say him by name. He came, he was a coworker of someone who was coming two or three times to events and said, come along, it's a Jewish party. And he came, I think, to a Purim party the first time, then to a Friday night dinner the second time.
That's how you get them, the drinks.
No, Purim parties are great. By the way, it's funny. You know that Yom Kippur is like the most attended Jewish event of all year. I'm like, stay home, Yom Kippur, come Purim. Like, you know, if you're going to come once, like, you know, what's the, right? Anyway, he came, and then interestingly, he said to me, I love this, I don't think I can come back. So I said, why? He said, I see he's wearing a kippah. So this is like a religious community, and I'm not religious at all. So I said, you should know, he put on the kippah 20 seconds ago before he walked in, right? And he's not religious either. Like, out of respect.
He was talking about someone else.
Someone else, right. Yeah, he saw somebody else. Yeah. Now, by the way, I'm the rabbi. I guess he expected me to wear a kippah. But he saw another, you know, someone he was sitting next to wearing a kippah. He said, this is a religious community. That's not me. And I said to him, you know, he's not religious either. And then I went back into my no labels, you know, story. And he's like, oh, wow. And it opened the door for him. And he's become one of our closest, most endearing, warmest relationships of connection. And he got engaged recently and he asked me to marry them. And like, that's, you know, when someone feels threatened from the smallest element of Judaism, but realizes that we don't judge and that we genuinely are open to everybody, that's the ideal.
Can I ask if this guy wears a kippah now?
No, he does not wear a kippah now.
And does that feel like a failure?
Absolutely not. No, it's a great question. Maybe I was too strong, but no, absolutely not. Because I don't know if his charity that he gives, and I don't know what charity he gives. I don't know if the kindness that he, you know, spends time with his mom, right, is more beloved to God than my kippah wearing, right? And that's really what it comes down to. The Talmud says, a great story in the Talmud about a scenario where if a terrorist would come and want to kill the chief rabbi, unless you kill the drunken bum on the street, right? The Talmud says you're not allowed to kill the drunken bum. So most people would assume that's because, you know, I can't kill. So if I can't kill the drunken bum, then whatever he does is, right? But the Talmud says a reason. It says, because you don't know whose blood is redder than whom. Right? And I think that's wild. What do you mean? Here's the chief rabbi. Here's the drunken bum. Of course I know who's more. And the Talmud says, no, you don't. You don't know what his circumstances were and his education and who his parents were and what his reality of his life, what his challenges are. You don't know who is more endearing to God, whose acts are more special, who has a higher place in the world to come, right? You don't know. And that is my guiding light in everything I do in my life. Mm. I don't know and I can't know what you're, if you're holier than I or I'm holier than you. Now, I might know that Shabbat is wonderful and I'll share it with you because it's wonderful, right? And you might be even greater then. But to say, to think for a moment that I'm greater, you know, there's a term that people use often in the kind of work that we do, kiruv, yeah? Right? The Lubavitcher Rebbe
kiruv
said—
kiruv means to—
I'll explain what it means.
Okay, yes.
Yeah, the Lubavitcher Rebbe said he hated that word, yeah? The Chabad Rebbe said that he hated that word because the word means close, to make close. So he said the connotation is that that person that you're talking to is far. He said, how do you know what Jew is far and what Jew is close? How do you decide that you're, and Rav Noach Weinberg at Eish, he used to teach us the same thing. He said, you can't judge another Jew. How do you know that you're greater than him? How do you know that his relationship with God isn't better? So on the outside, people would say, oh, kosher, Shabbat, you know, Israel, I don't know, like, you know, they, people have everyone has their own list, by the way, because whatever. I have a dear brother, yeah, shout out to my bro, yeah, who always likes to tell people he's not religious. I'm not religious, okay? Then when they say, oh, you want to join us at, you know, Broadway Friday night? He says, no, no, I can't go Friday night because I keep Shabbat. I'm like, okay. And then they invite him a little later to, you know, out to eat. And he's like, no, I can't go to that restaurant because I keep kosher. And eventually they catch on. They're like, wait a second. I thought you said you weren't religious. He said, yeah, I say that because that way you're like, oh, wow, you're not religious and you keep Shabbat. You're not religious and you keep kosher. You're not religious and you're going to go, you know, learn Torah for an hour a week, whatever it might be, right? Wow, that's amazing, right? He said, if I told you that I am religious, then you start looking at me and say, oh, but you said it negative, you know, you did this, you did that, right? People start looking at all the things you don't do, right? I like to try to believe that I could look at a human and not look or judge any of their actions. It's not for me to judge. I don't know.
It reminds me, you know, I grow up and I'm open about it. I'm an atheist. I'm very Jewish and everything.
Baruch Hashem. And,
thank God. Yeah. Thank God I'm an atheist. Right. But it's, you know, I grew up and I always felt like I have some problem with organized religion. And I've always thought that my problem was with religion. And only recently I realized my problem is with the organized. I have no problem with the religion. It's just when someone tells me, here's how you do it. Here's the organization. Here's the thing. You know, you come and I, you know, sometimes when I go to synagogue, I've noticed 50% of the time you spend looking at the book and 50% of the time you spend looking at someone else's book to see what page you're on, right? And it's the organization that rubs me the wrong way, not the religion. So I love that. I wish we could talk more. There's so much I want to talk about. There's one thing that I want to ask you, because I believe there is space for 20,000 more keys. If someone wants to start their own organization, like Key, maybe a franchise, or maybe something else based on their values, what would you give them? What advice? What are the obstacles that you have faced starting your own thing? What have you learned?
Wow, that's a great question. The biggest obstacle, I think this is true for all nonprofits, is fundraising. Yeah, the challenge in New York, I feel, is that everyone recommends and compliments and has high praise for the startup, but woe to the person who starts it. Yeah. Everyone wants new things, but then, oh, the establishment and why do we need and is it really necessary? If you find a niche, believe in it and go for it. Yeah. If you find something that's missing or lacking, you know, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks used to always say, and I was blessed with a very special relationship with him in England. He always used to say that, you know, if you want to know where you're supposed to be, what you're supposed to do. And I think this is the advice that I would give someone who wants to start a branch of Key. Figure out what your skill set is. Figure out what the needs are. And when those two things overlap, in that space of the need and your skill set, that's where you're supposed to be. And I think that's true for the needs of the community and for the startup nation and for the startup, you know, communities. But I think that, you know, reinventing the wheel or just doing, you know, and not seeing things through the eyes, and maybe this is the second thing. Make sure you're seeing things accurate to the way that people are seeing them, right? You know, it's always a challenge when you're talking to people to make sure that they're hearing what you're saying. And then when you're listening to them, you're actually defining their terms. Make sure you understand what they're saying. So if you think there's a need for a community, but there isn't actually. Or they're telling you one thing, but really they're saying something else. Your offerings are never going to match. You need to be able to really listen carefully to what people need and then be able to provide that.
Wow, that's beautiful. Man, I have so many more questions. And
let's do a rapid fire.
But we are getting to the
okay.
Here I Am lightning round of series of rapid fire questions where there's no right or wrong answer.
Ooh, okay.
First thing that comes to mind.
Okay.
And I know you got this. Rabbi Moshe Merrifield, what is one thing people don't know about you?
That I was nervous when I came to the podcast.
Doesn't show. What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
That we're going to be around forever and that we have zero concern of our longevity. We're going to be here forever. And I think that our belief in that, our knowledge of that is important. People are very nervous about Manhattan, about the elections coming up, as am I. But as my rabbi and mentor, Rabbi Breil Warren, used to say, and I'm dating myself here, but there was terrible infighting in the Knesset, Shulam and Aloni and the Shas party. And I said to him, Rabbi, what's going to be? He said, Moshe, this is just another board meeting of a synagogue in Poland, 1922, right? Like, we've been through this. It's okay. We're going to be okay. The Jewish people are going to be okay. The individual Jews, that we have to worry about. But the community, the entity of the Jewish people, we're going to be around forever.
I hope you're right. When was the last time you cried?
This morning. I'm a crier. I'm very emotional. The Jewish people inspire me. And when I see things good and wonderful and powerful, the truth is, I think what I cried from this morning, I probably cried from five times, but I watched the Omer Adam intro again. Of his concert with the mirage, the quick fire series of hugs of hostages coming home to their families, and I'm crying now. I just can't. You know, I met Dani Omri's Miran's father in Israel. I spent time with the hostage families, and that's actually where we met at a rally for the hostages in Central Park. And, you know, his beard is beautiful and white, and he said he wouldn't cut it until his son comes home. And to see him embrace his son, there's no word to describe what joy, what love, what genuine awe that is.
Yeah. If you could have any Jewish person over for a Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, dead or living, who would that be?
Shai Davidai.
That you're aiming low.
you're low. Coming already.
Well, the best podcaster in the world,
right,
other than that.
Right, you're coming. Now, if I could have any Jew in the history of the Jewish people, who would it be? It have to be Jewish?
It doesn't have to be Jewish.
Ask the question again.
So I'll ask it. If you could have any person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, dead or living, who would that be?
I'm going to take two. I'd like the Wright brothers. I love the fact that they created something that everyone dreamed about but never made happen. The Wright brothers took flight and made it a reality. And if you think about the biggest change in the world in the last 100 years, the fact that we can travel, you would just thank God in Israel and back. And I mean, I saw you last week and you've been back and forth since. And, you know, and it's relatively inexpensive. Flight has changed our lives. I love the Wright brothers' dream to reality, and I'm very inspired by them.
Wow, that's a great answer. What is your favorite Jewish holiday?
Whichever is coming next. My kids always say that. I always say that every Jewish holiday is my favorite, and then I say it about the next one. I'm like, didn't you say that about the last one? And so
it's hard for you. We're now in Cheshvan. Jewish month with no holidays. Yeah.
I think Passover. I think Passover. As a kid, I struggled with it, like many people do, and as an adult, you know, we talked about the eternity of the Jewish people from slavery to freedom, from hope to reality of going to the land of Israel. You know, there's Zionism there, there's community there, there's individuality there, there's leadership, there's Moses. I think Passover has within it a microcosm of the entire story of the Jewish people.
Do you have a least favorite Jewish holiday?
Do I have a least?
It's still favorite, but least.
I'm going to say Yom Kippur, but not for the obvious reason. I think what Yom Kippur has become, I don't like. What Yom Kippur is, I'm obsessed with. The fact that we're not defined by our past, the fact that we can be anything, the fact that we can, that we're not bodies, we're souls, and we can achieve great things, and therefore we don't eat. And, do, you know, again, it's not something we live normally that way in Judaism, but the fact that we have the ability to soar with our soul. I love Yom Kippur, but the unnecessary length of time that we spend in the synagogue. I think the words that we say, which people don't relate to and don't understand, I think it's asking for trouble. I think that to ourselves as a community, we've created a monster and we can't deal with it. So I would say not what Yom Kippur is, but what we've created Yom Kippur to be is my least favorite. And I spend a lot of time trying to undo that with Key. We try to teach people what Yom Kippur really is and have shorter services and pray in English and understand the beauty of the opportunity that Yom Kippur has to offer.
When do you feel safest?
This is supposed to be rapid. When do I feel safest? When I land in Israel.
When do you feel least safe?
When I don't know where my children are.
Yeah, and with 8 children, that's tough.
Yeah.
That's very tough.
WhatsApp check-ins, you know. I think that, again, that's a mirror to the way I live my life. I want to know where all the children are. I want to know where everybody is. Not actually. I don't need I don't need a pin on their location, but I need to know that they're
our mental space, where they are in the world and their journey.
Yeah, and that they know that people love them, and that they know the Jewish people are a wonderful thing to be part of, and that they have a community to connect to, and that the land of Israel is going to be there for them. And that I want them to know that. When they don't, I feel unsafe.
What gives you hope?
Conversations like this, genuinely. The tragic murder of Charlie Kirk, the fact that people disagree because of their voice, and disagreement. I think, that Judaism is built on arguments and disagreements, and that's beautiful. The Talmud and Passover, asking questions and demanding answers, and right? That's who we are. That's what life is meant to be. So when that's threatened, that's very dangerous. When people can have conversations that are not obvious, that they can have differences and look different and be different, and kind of, the fact that there's room for conversations, and that's why I'm so happy that podcasts like this exist. And I've looked at your list of, of guests that you've had.
I'm so grateful for each and every one that has come.
It's genuinely an amazing thing. Like, that's a beautiful thing. That's what gives me hope, the fact that we can have conversations and we can disagree. Yeah. And it's okay. And not that we did tonight.
Oh, don't worry. Once we turn off the cameras, boom, we start.
Right? But the fact that we might live our lives differently. We might choose to do different things differently. But the fact that we have conversations, and when I walked in, it wasn't on camera, but I got a big hug from you, right? That gives me hope.
Thank you for saying that. Finally, every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel, the Jewish diaspora, or the world in large. Now, I'm going to say KII, go and donate. But from your perspective, where would you want people to donate to this week?
After they donate to KII.
After they donate. Whatever they have left after.
I am amazed at the amount of giving that the Jewish people do. I'm amazed at at our heart and our soul and our desire to give. I think that it's amazing. But I think that, we always talk about family and community and friends and the circles. I feel that the challenges of families in Israel struggling today is very, very close to my heart. The fact that there are people that don't have food on their tables to eat. And I'm not going to say a specific charity, but I would really love people to share with people who don't have in Israel to make sure that, we're so blessed. We're so blessed today. And before we were turning off all the phones, and one phone and two phones, and some people have 3 phones and there's like different devices. We have so much. And if you don't have monetary things to give, everybody has something to give. go volunteer at Leket and help them, you know, divide up the food for the for people that are in need. You don't, you know, money is only one way of giving. You know, our body is actually another way of giving. And whether it's a kind word or whether it's a, you know, or time to dedicate to chesed, to kindness, you know, help people that don't have in the land of Israel.
Moshe, where can people find you? Where can they find Ki?
I'm very accessible. Ki is spelled kii-nyc.com/donate. But just the website itself is there. We're much more active on Instagram than anywhere else.
Where can they find it on Instagram?
KII_NYC. Follow us. You'll probably see this episode reshared there. You know, we have an amazing a plethora of activities. You can message me on Key's Instagram. You can message me on my own, M. Meyerfeld. M-M-A-Y-E-R-F-E-L-D. Reach out to me. I'm incredibly accessible, available, and happy to connect.
Oh, man, this has been a delight. I got through half the things I wanted to talk about, but that's just a good thing. That means we're going to have to do this again, and Okay. Hopefully next time with Liat. So
it's only one chair, but she'll have to be in it.
We'll make sure. Don't worry. Okay. I'll take care of that. And I'm just glad to say, here I am with Rabbi Moshe Meyerfeld.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at the Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21+. Terms and conditions apply.